Hey there, podcast listeners. It's Courtney here with a special offer just for you. My new book is coming out in April. It's called Looking Up, A Birder's Guide to Hope Through Grief. It's all about grief and sorrow and the ways that birds and birding can bring us to a place of hope. It's a book of faith. It's a book of humor. We would love to give you a 20% discount. You can use this code, IVPPOD20. That's IVPPOD20. That code will give you 20% off and free shipping anywhere in the U.S. when you order from ivpress.com. Pick up your copy of Looking Up, A Birder's Guide to Hope Through Grief today. Hope is the thing with feathers.
Hope is the thing with feathers.
That's like a bird.
Like a bird.
That perches in the soul.
That perches in the soul. Welcome to the Thing with Feathers podcast, a podcast about birds and hope. I'm your host, birding enthusiast, Courtney Ellis. Welcome back to the Thing with Feathers podcast. I'm your host, Courtney Ellis. Today with us, we are blessed to have Dr. Andrew Walsh. Andrew is the Chief Science Officer at Health Monitoring, a public health software company, helping epidemiologists make the most of the ever-increasing volume of available healthcare data. He's the author of Faith Across the Multiverse, which was with Rose Hendrickson Publishing, which was my first publisher of my first book. So we're kins in the publishing world. And he writes a regular science and faith blog for InterVarsity's Emerging Scholars Network. Welcome, Andrew.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Andrew, it's so good to have you. I came across your work from an article that was shared on Twitter about the renaming of birds that are named after people. And for those who haven't heard, this was a decision the American Ornithological Society came to on November 1st of 2023, deciding to rename all birds named after people. So birds like the Say's Phoebe or the Lincoln Sparrow are now going to get new names. Walk us through that story.
Sure. Yeah, so I write regularly for InterVarsity on topics of science, wide-ranging topics of science, and always looking for things that will be of interest to folks who aren't scientists. And I figured, you know, everywhere you're seeing stories about things getting renamed or, you know, buildings, institutions, statues coming down, you know, we're currently going through quite a moment of redeciding who we want to honor and who perhaps we want to be done honoring in that way. And so, you know, here was a story that intersected with that in terms of a scientific topic, right? The names of the common names of birds, so not the Latin scientific names. Those aren't changing. And sometimes those are also named for people, you know, either the person who made the discovery or celebrities and so forth. I think like Gary Larson of the Far Side cartoons has various critters named after him and other notable people. You know, there's lots and lots of species of birds and everything else, and you run out of names pretty quickly. And so you're looking for inspiration everywhere. So those scientific names aren't changing, but the common names for people, they've decided North American birds that the American Ornithological Society is responsible for, they're changing names, and they're changing all the names that reference, all the bird names that reference human names. So not just the ones that they've decided aren't worthy or meet some criteria. They just kind of went ahead with a blanket. That's not a helpful way to do things, and we don't want to be the ones who have to decide who gets to keep their name associated with the bird and who doesn't. So they're just changing all the names to names to be named later that will hopefully be more descriptive or more memorable. One of the challenging things cognitively about names that we know from neuroscience is that it's actually hard to remember arbitrary names, because there are so many different things that can point to the same name, right? But, you know, a name like Andrew, you may know many people that have the name Andrew, and they have nothing in common other than that's their first name. And so there's nothing to help you kind of build connections there. And so that experience of trying to remember somebody's name and like it's right on the tip of your tongue, that might actually be a neurological phenomenon of like the neurons that are connected from whatever you started from fire, and then they get to that point where it connects to the name and it conks out, and like there's a physical action there, which I can't quite get it's right on the tip of my tongue. So there's benefits to changing these names, even if it wasn't, you know, even if there weren't concerns about who these people were or who were honoring with these names. It's just sometimes better to have a name that means something, that's more connected to what the bird looks like or behaves or anything like that. And so it made a lot of sense to me, and I thought that was a useful way to approach that conversation of why we're changing different names and how to go about it. You know, some decisions maybe seem a little bit more arbitrary or a little bit more punitive, but I felt like this was an approach that felt a little bit more gracious, or at least consistent and thought through, so as to be more generous to all the folks that would be impacted.
I know among the birding community, a lot of folks have said, that's really exciting because then I need to buy new field guides.
Sure.
All the names are going to be different.
Sure. And no one is presumably more excited than the field guide publishers.
Right. It's a win-win for the publishers for sure. But one of the joys for me of birding is that classification and learning the names and learning the species and realizing like, oh, there's going to be more to learn now is exciting to me.
And I wonder too, how many folks will take that as an opportunity to re-add those birds to their lifetime identification, lifetime spotting lists under their new names.
Right. I hadn't thought about that, but does it count if you saw the Lincoln sparrow, but now it's a buff colored sparrow, or it's a, you know, the sparrows are going to be hard because to name a sparrow after a physical characteristic, like they all look very similar. So I wonder if they'll name them based on places or, you know, this is the thicket sparrow that likes to hang out in the thicket, although that's 2/3 of sparrows also.
Yeah, I'm glad that it's not my job to have to come up with the new names.
Absolutely. What did you think of their decision to rename all of them? So they didn't have to sit there and say, is this a good guy or a bad guy, a good girl or a bad girl? You know, can we keep this name? We're just going to rename all of them.
Yeah, that made a lot of sense to me as an approach that would be more consistent and probably easier to justify to a wide range of people, easier to explain, and easier to implement too, right? You don't have to go through and make decisions and figure out and communicate that. It's a much easier message to communicate. It's just any name that contains a person's name. Whether that can be applied across the board, probably not every institution that's facing this question can take the same tack. One of the other things that's getting renamed a lot, right, is university buildings and departments and so forth. Right. And there's money attached to that. And there's people that, you know, they want to continue to represent. So there would be consequences to just saying, no, they're all, you know, building 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Right. So maybe not everybody can take that approach, but where it was possible, it seemed like a good way to go about it to me.
The building 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is just not a very lyrical way to do things. We got to find something else, right?
Yeah. I want to say MIT has something like that, but maybe I'm misremembering.
But that would be very MIT.
Yeah.
We're about logic. We're about numbers. Well, Andrew, you've also done work through your public health background around West Nile virus, which is something birders have been really, really concerned about, in part because it can spread from birds to humans, which isn't great for us, but also in part because there have been seasons for so many of us where we go out and you just see dead birds all over. And it's so tragic. What do you know about West Nile? Are we making any progress?
Sure. Yeah. So I started my grad school in public health and infectious disease biology in the year 2000. And so it was right before the West Nile virus was introduced to the United States. And so my advisor got a grant to study the mosquitoes that transmit West Nile virus between birds and then from birds to humans, because his lab, the focus was on the ecology of infectious diseases. His background was in diseases carried by mammals, hantavirus and some other related viruses that are transmitted from mammals to people. And so, you know, the ecology of the mosquitoes and the birds was an interesting topic and fit with his lab. And so what I was working on was part mosquito collection, data collection, and part data analysis. So we were trying to understand whether you could use the weather to predict on any given day how many mosquitoes are going to be flying around, and then on any given year how many mosquitoes are going to be flying around, by looking at how cold the winter was and how sort of severe the wet winter was. Mosquitoes like many animals in temperate zones, have to navigate all four seasons and have to figure out what to do when it gets really cold. And because they're not warm-blooded, right, that impacts their metabolism. And so some mosquitoes go through a period where it's not called hibernating in mosquitoes, but it's the same kind of concept. They get quiescent, they go somewhere and just sort of chill, either as adults or as eggs for the duration of the winter. So other mosquitoes remain active, but just kind of hiding in places where it's warm, underground tunnels and so forth. And so we were looking to see whether you could predict from season to season, whether there'd be more mosquitoes or fewer mosquitoes based on the weather that it occurred over the winter. And then again, like I said, on a day-to-day basis, how many mosquitoes are we going to be flying around based on how much rainfall there's been recently, which, you know, impacts how many eggs hatch, and whether it's raining currently, which impacts whether the mosquitoes can fly around, all of which factors into whether, you know, people and birds are at risk of getting the virus because the mosquitoes are out and active. That was the research that I was doing. It also involved a lot of just driving around and catching mosquitoes, which is a process that involves hanging coolers of dry ice on a tree and wiring that up to a car battery that drives a fan and a light. And the light and the carbon dioxide from the dry ice attract the mosquitoes. And then the fan pushes them down into a cup so that they can't fly back out. And then you collect them in the morning. And in my case, you take them to a guy at the Maryland Department of Agriculture who has to look at them all and determine which of the 63 different species of mosquito that are native to Maryland, which of them they were. And if you think telling the difference between sparrows is tricky, you don't have to get them under the microscope, right, to tell. He had to look at them pretty closely to figure out which of the different 63 species there were. And then count them up to see, what species are out there. Are they the species that cause, you know, that create risk for disease transmission? Because only some species of mosquitoes feed on birds, and even fewer species of mosquitoes feed on birds and people. And so, you know, they were tracking those kinds of things to then know that, you know, the Department of Agriculture was interested in the question, where do we need to send the spray trucks today to protect people and birds? And we were interested just in the question of how many mosquitoes are there today so that we can compare it to the weather from yesterday and last week and so forth. So it was a kind of a win-win. They got some cheap labor for driving around to collect the mosquitoes, and we got help with collecting data. So that was, you know, and that was about 20 years ago that I was working on that. But yeah, that was my experience with West Nile virus research.
I'm still stuck on the 63 different types of mosquitoes in Maryland. I had no idea.
Yeah. And, you know, it varies a little bit in different parts of the U.S., but yeah, it's something on the order of 50 or 60 species probably in most states.
That's too many.
It is. Not all of them feed on people. Not all of them feed on, animals. Some of them get their energy from plants. Not all of them are concerned for disease, but they're all attracted to, you know, the traps, the light and so forth. And so you had to be able to differentiate between all of them.
Well, I want to move to some of your work in public health. It has not been an easy season to be working in public health. Things felt like they got very political and very contentious when, we have several folks who work in public health who attend our church and they're like, we're just trying to keep you alive. Like it's, you know, just, tell us a little bit about, your work in public health and some of the lessons you hope we can learn, both as people of faith, for those of us who are, but also just as American society. What are the lessons you hope we take from the COVID-19 pandemic?
Sure. Yeah, thanks. So after doing that mosquito West Nile research and trying to build those models of using the weather to predict predict how many mosquitoes there would be, I developed some analytical skills, some data and statistics skills. So I used that to transition to working for a software company that does public health data collection and data analysis. We do provide a service called syndromic surveillance to public health departments. So what that means, so traditional public health surveillance, and I used to have to explain this in a lot more detail, but now we've all lived through, you know, we all know exactly how it works. You get sick, you test positive for something that's reportable, and the doctor or the lab that gets the positive result has to call the public health department and say, hey, so-and-so tested positive for COVID-19 or measles or whatever the case might be, or West Nile virus. And, you know, that's very specific and very passive on the part of the health department. They're just kind of waiting for these confirmed results. But with the advent of electronic healthcare data, there was a movement to say, hey, look, people are collecting data all the time. It takes a while for test results to come in, diagnoses to come in. But when you walk into the hospital, you know exactly why you came. You have a fever, you have a cough, you fell down and you're worried you broke your arm, you were in a motor vehicle collision, whatever it is, you know why you're there. You may not know exactly the cause of it in the case of a fever or a cough, but you know why you're there. And that can tell us something about what's going on in a region at a community level. So we collect emergency department registration data, and we collect that text of what it is that you said you came in for. And it might just be a single word like cough or fever. It might be a whole story of, you know, where you were going and how you fell down and why you think you broke your arm and, you know, what happened to you in the ambulance on the way over there. It varies. And so we have to parse out that text data and put it into different categories. And then we track, okay, how many people are coughing in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania this week? Or how many people in, Tulare County, California are experiencing heat-related illnesses or whatever the case may be. We have a whole range of categories related to infectious diseases, related to injuries, related to drug overdoses, all kinds of things, because all those things go through the hospital. And then we look for those unusual patterns. That was something that nobody understood and nobody paid attention to, you know, outside of the world of public health for many years. And then all of a sudden, it became an area of intense focus starting in early 2020. You know, we were starting with looking for, okay, who has symptoms of a respiratory illness and said that they were recently in China. And for several weeks, that was what we were focused on and kind of refining how do we identify who's been to China and not. And then it spread to Italy and some of these other countries. And there were all these different travel advisories. And every day I was updating, okay, which countries are we looking for now? Which countries are we concerned about? And then it was here. We didn't initially have a lot of testing available. And so being able to just say, okay, how many people have a cough? How many people have a sore throat? How many people have shortness of breath in these different hospitals, in these different areas? That was relevant information because that was very timely. You know, we get that as soon as you walk into the hospital, we get that information. So it's timely, and it's, while it's not specific, it does track trends of what's going on in these areas. And so once we started to get those case data, you could see, you know, our numbers tracked very closely with the official case counts, usually ahead by a couple of days, right? Because of that lag in terms of when the test results come in and get reported. But you could track that. We spent a lot of time just trying to figure out, you know, how can we help? What more can we do? We collect emergency department data. We were trying to collect inpatient data to be able to say, okay, how many folks are using respirators? How many ICU beds are occupied by COVID-19 patients? To get as much useful information as possible into the hands of the people that needed it. So that was what we were doing that time. Counting the days until the vaccine was approved and all that. And, you know, we would have company-wide seminars and invite friends and family to answer questions of, okay, what is this virus and what's the vaccine? And is it, you know, is the vaccine safe? And what's the difference between an mRNA vaccine and a, you know, more traditional vaccine and so forth, all that kind of stuff. Cause people had lots of questions and we were just trying to do the best that we could to help folks get information. Both the healthcare information that we were getting as part of our contracts and so forth, but also just the science information and the public health expertise that we had to make available to folks outside of public health departments.
Mm. Thank you for your work there. It's important stuff. And like you said, it was kind of invisible and thankless. And then the pandemic started and it feels like half the country was very grateful and half the country was very mad at you for just doing your job.
Yeah, that was an interesting experience. And we can definitely see the toll that it's taken. There were people that we used to work with in the public health departments that aren't there anymore, that just kind of had enough or needed to move into another part of public health or something like that. So yeah, it's been difficult to kind of deal with that experience of, well, we thought, I got into this to help people, and the values that led me in that direction came from the faith communities that I grew up in, and those were some of the faith communities that said, oh, we're not actually sure we trust public health anymore. And it was, that was hard to deal with, but that wasn't the only experience. There were certainly also people that were more receptive and more welcoming of the information, and so just kind of navigate through that as it came.
Mm. I remember being so grateful. We have a couple of public health professionals in our church, and March of 2020, when all this is happening, I was on the phone with them all the time saying, like, please help us to help our community. We sat down with our statistics at church and realized we had 200 members over 80 years old that were at highest risk for this. And so we made a lot of really tough decisions as a church. But speaking as someone from a faith community, where I am personally just very grateful for the work that you all have done, and just the honesty and integrity in the face of a lot of just seemingly to me just bizarre opposition when you were really trying to just keep people alive. Thank you.
Well, to the extent that I helped with that, you're welcome.
And tell us a little bit about some of the lessons that you've seen people learn coming through that COVID season, and some of the lessons that we haven't learned that you hope we might.
Sure. So one of the things that I said early on was that, I hope that we would take some of these mitigation efforts that we were implementing, not all of them, obviously the strictest, most severe kinds of things when, people couldn't go to work and people couldn't be with their families, right? Obviously that was a very serious time that, we had to do because we had no other options. But some of these other tools that we have now, that we've always had, right? Masks, better air ventilation, things like that. Those are relevant to all kinds of respiratory illnesses. Tens of thousands of people die from influenza every year in the United States alone. And we saw dramatic reductions in the number of influenza cases over the winter of 2020 into 2021, and also 2021 into 2022. By that point, we were not in those, strong lockdown conditions, or, we were not having to, completely eliminate all sort of out of the house activities from our lives. There were a lot of people that were going back to doing a lot of the things that they were used to, but we were wearing masks and taking some other measures, and we still saw a significant reduction in the number of flu cases. And so I hope that we would find some kind of level that wasn't exactly back to nothing, but it certainly wasn't March of 2020 kind of conditions either, that would help to mitigate some of those influenza cases, RSV cases, and of course, with still the ongoing COVID-19 cases. There's still some of that, right? I it's rare that I go out into the world and see no one wearing a mask when in the context of any kind of gathering of more than a few people. I'm sure there are people have all kinds of reasons for that, from their own personal, health risks, to they're recovering from something and they want to protect people, as they're recovering, to just, I want to be on team, I think there's people that are still kind of holding on to that, I'm team public health, I'm team wear a mask everywhere kind of thing. And whatever the reasons, there is still some of that. But I'm a little bit surprised that there isn't more, especially in certain contexts. When I see my family, right, I don't want to wear a mask because I want to talk to people and be close to people and so forth. But if I'm at the grocery store or the mall or at a concert or something where I'm just kind of sitting there passively, it doesn't bother me much to have a mask on, because I'm not really, I wouldn't be interacting with other people, more than just a casual hi or, excuse me kind of thing anyway. So I don't feel like the mask is a barrier in that case. And so it makes sense, to do it there, but, and depending on the context, right, especially more so in the winter months where these things circulate more widely, especially in the context of folks where there's going to be higher risk folks in those contexts. We are in a situation where there's a lot of, it's up to your own personal kind of navigation. And I get that, people don't want to necessarily deal with that. I don't want to have to make that decision every time I walk out the door. But I do think that, we could maybe have some more education on here, the things where it would be most helpful. Here are the things where it's maybe not necessary or not the biggest bang for the buck, so that folks had some guidance. And, you know, improving air ventilation in public spaces, right? That's something that I, you know, doesn't require an individual by individual decision on a day by day basis. It's something that we can invest in as a society and get a lot of benefit from for in those, you know, large gathering spaces, right? Or even our schools and our churches and so forth. And I'm sure, you know, everybody who is responsible for a church, you know, feels that they don't have nearly enough money to do that sort of thing. And I'm sure schools, many school districts feel the same, right? So it's not just a matter of, you know, wagging our fingers at the churches to make them do, or the schools or the other buildings, right? We need to kind of collectively decide that this is something we want to invest in, but it's something that we could and would provide a lot of benefit for a wide range of conditions, not just COVID and not just the flu. And then the other thing that I think, and this isn't so much my idea, but I heard someone talk about recently, we developed a lot of testing capacity during the early days of the pandemic, particularly in university settings, right? Universities were doing a lot of testing on a regular basis of their students to be able to operate their classes and function at the level that they needed to function at. And, you know, that testing capacity would be useful for, again, a wide range of conditions. PCR tests, the tests that we use to identify the COVID-19 virus, you can use to identify pretty much any virus or bacterium or parasite or fungus that causes disease in people, in animals, in all kinds of contexts. And so that testing capacity, the basic ingredients for that and the equipment for that have a wide range of uses. We could be putting that to more use and making sure that that's available when we do have, you know, the need for kind of a surge. And it's unclear to me where that capacity is being used now, if we've maintained that. Somebody else was speaking on this topic who was more knowledgeable on it than I am. And that particular issue was saying, you know, that we needed to make sure that capacity was maintained. So that made a lot of sense to me. And that, you know, that can be used for, even just flu testing and things like that. It was kind of surprising to me when I first started working with the public health data at the company where I work, to learn that, you know, there's not as much testing as you would think there would be, even in a hospital setting. They kind of, if a patient has a respiratory illness, they treat that, and the treatment is kind of the same regardless of what the pathogen is. You know, unless it's a bacterial infection where there's antibiotics, we didn't have a lot of medication. You know, if it's a viral infection, we didn't have a lot of medications for those other than things that would treat the symptoms. And so there wasn't a whole lot of value to identifying, there wasn't a lot of clinical value for the individual patients to identify what exactly was making them sick. However, there's a lot of public health value to understanding what's going around at any given time and to know where we need to target maybe vaccine campaigns or, you know, other mitigation efforts and so forth. So yeah, we could be doing a lot more just on a routine basis to understand what's out there in the world, what's going on, and how do we best navigate that. Hopefully those things will, you know, I'm not aware of any, you know, big agendas to move any of that forward at a national level. Hopefully if we continue to talk about these things and keep them, you know, keep aware of what's going on, maybe we'll see some changes over time.
I will say, as a parent of three young children, I would so love to have a test that would just tell me allergies or not, because we have things blooming here. I live in Southern California all year long. And if it's allergies, they go to school no problem. But I don't want them to spread something. And it's almost a daily, you know, our kids are so adept at the, like, oh, here comes the COVID test. But that's the only thing I can test for, you know. And so as a parent of young kids trying to be responsible in this public health space, that would be such a gift.
Yeah. So there are PCR devices that you can buy to have in your home, and then you get the test kit is essentially a cartridge that you plug into the machine and it runs the PCR. And that, again, you could use that for anything. You can do multiple viruses in the same sample, right? So you could do one swab and test for the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the various influenza viruses, RSV, the various viruses that cause a common cold, some common bacterial pathogens that cause respiratory illnesses, In theory, you could put all kinds of things in the same same test cartridge, and get a result. Now, that might get that might make for some fairly expensive cartridges, and so they might have to fine tune that to be the most likely things. But yeah, you could get a more comprehensive answer than just, well, it's not COVID, right? or it is COVID, right? But not COVID still covers a wide range of things, including allergies, but also including other infectious conditions. And so, yeah, a more comprehensive home test that you could do and get an answer in 15 minutes, that would be amazing. And the technology is there. There was a company that was selling those. My boss looked at getting them for us, for our employees. But by the time it became available, it was only they were only selling it in volume to large employers. And we only have about a dozen employees. And so, yeah, I don't think you could get one for your home either, but there's nothing, that was just because there wasn't enough demand for it. So they didn't scale up to the kind of level that it would be available at a consumer basis, but there's no technical reason why that couldn't be the case. Right. It's just a lack of interest and demand. So yeah, there are things there that we could do. And there might even be something more straightforward that might be able to answer the question of, is it allergies, right? That might even be cheaper answers to that question. But again, we'd have to invest in that to make it available on a, home over-the-counter basis.
Hmm. So much of science boils down to what is the question we want answered and how willing are we to go after it? It's
exactly
how
willing, yeah.
Yeah, I think of you putting all those buckets and those machines on the trees to count the mosquitoes, right? Like it's not always a simple process to find the answers that you're looking for.
Yeah, that was an all day activity to drive around the state, and well, we were on a weekly basis. Over the course of a week, we would cover most of the state and then go back through and go to those same sites again the next week and so on and so forth. But yeah, that was quite an endeavor. And the folks who sold me the 25 pounds of dry ice every morning were just mystified by what in the world I was doing.
I thought you're some sort of mad scientist.
Yeah, until I finally explained it to them. But yeah, they're like, why are you here every day?
And you explained it to them and then they knew you were a mad scientist.
So exactly.
Just pushed
exactly.
It for them.
Yeah.
Well, Andrew, you make the case in your beautiful book that faith and science don't have to be enemies. Unpack that a little bit. How can you be a person of faith and a big believer in science? Aren't those two things vehemently opposed? Shouldn't we just read our Bibles and be quiet about it?
If you want them to be, you can find people who will help you in that endeavor. But historically they haven't been. Historically, the sciences, the methods of science, and the facts that we've learned from those methods have been developed by a number of people who belong to various faith communities, Christian, Islamic faith communities, Jewish faith communities, and so forth, at least, in the Western tradition, and obviously in there are other things as well. Even today, there are, I always like to point people, there's actually a Wikipedia page. There's just a list of Christians who are scientists or lists of scientists who are Christians or religious believers. I forget exactly the title of the page. But
there's more than one. It's not just you.
Yeah, no. I'm not even on that page because I'm not nearly notable enough of a scientist to be on Wikipedia. And, that's fine. The Wikipedia is not a source you would think of being particularly invested. Like, they don't have a particular dog in the fight of, whether faith and science go together or not. But there's enough people that felt like that it was worthwhile maintaining this list. There are hundreds of current scientists and then lots of other, past scientists who are on just that page, as well as, plenty of other resources. So there's plenty of examples there. My own interest in writing that book, I feel like a lot of people who aren't scientists who come from some kind of faith tradition see science as, either unrelated and possibly, more in the realm of technology, right? Like, we like the science of computers that allow us to have conversations across a continent. We like the technology of, our cars that, more fuel efficient so they can save us money. And like, there's all kinds of technologies that we like as a result of science, smartphones and all the things that the nifty things they can do. But when science does interact with areas that previously a focus of religion and faith communities, it seems like it's taking something away, right? We used to believe that God caused X, and now we know it's, you know, condensation of water and so forth. We, you know, that we used to believe that God sent the rains, and now it's, now we just know about clouds and moisture in the water cycle and so forth, right? And that's, you know, useful to us in terms of planning agriculture and predicting the weather, but it, it takes away some of that mystery or awe or maybe even opportunity for worship and so forth. And so I wanted to demonstrate that there are things that science gives back to people of faith by going through and talking about the ways that we can use the language and the concepts of science as analogies to discuss topics of that come up in theology and in faith discussions, right? So, and the Bible is full of this, right? The, when God has to explain things about himself, he often references features of the world that he created, right? The number of stars in the sky, or the number of grains of sand on the beach, or, you know, behavioral or attributes of different animals, right? God uses all those things to kind of explain things about himself, either directly or through folks like, you know, the psalmists and the prophets and so forth. Jesus, you know, used many analogies of the natural world, you know, things about plants and seeds and birds of the field and all kinds of different metaphors there, and Paul as well. And so, you know, I wanted to just kind of push that that tradition and that pattern forward a little bit by using contemporary science, looking at things like the mathematics of chaos theory, or the biology of developmental biology and how humans grow from a single cell to a full complex human, or, you know, things that we've learned from computer science about how algorithms work and how to best organize our computers and so forth. You know, using those language and using those concepts to talk about the things of faith, maybe not necessarily, you know, not trying to invent a new theology, just a new way of talking about familiar theology so that you can build more connections between those different areas.
Mm. Well, Andrew, in your work with faith and your work with science and your work in public health, I'm going to close with our two standard podcast questions. And the first is, where are you finding hope these days? You have feet in both worlds, the faith world and the science world. Where are you finding hope?
Yeah, I think one big source of hope at the moment is my kids and the community around my kids. They are a junior and a senior in high school. And so they are, you know, getting ready to go out into the world on their own a little bit more. And it's neat to see the communities around them, their friends, and the optimism that they have, the energy that they have for making the world better for not just themselves, but for the people around them, that, you know, the different volunteer activities that they're involved in, the organizations that they're involved in, that are trying to make sure that, you know, everybody is included and gets an opportunity to participate in, you know, school activities and social, you know, the broader society activities, right? Making sure that everybody's got food on the table and all those kinds of things. And so that's, you know, I think that's a positive thing for the future, that the next generation seems to have a few things straightened out.
So true. On occasion, I interview a young birder on this podcast, and they just have this whole perspective of like, no, we can do this. We can fix some of these things. Like, here's mm-hmm. my reusable water bottle, you know, from a change that small, like, this is right. what we do now. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful to watch. Okay. Yeah. Hardest question of the show. Are you ready?
Sure.
What is your favorite bird, Andrew?
Okay. So my favorite bird goes by the name Big Bird, but not the one you're thinking of. It is a species of Darwin's finch that has been identified as having emerged very recently in the span of a few generations. A hybrid event created an entirely new species of Darwin's finch. And the current name for it is just Big Bird. It hasn't gotten an official name, and presumably now whatever that name is, it won't be named for someone. Yeah, and so there's still, I think, debates as to exactly how to speciate it and so forth. But it, you know, it seems pretty clear that it has its own distinct behavior, its own distinct song, and that the, you know, this population is breeding only within itself and not, you know, interbreeding with the other populations of finches or Darwin's finches around it, which are not true finches. And so I just think it's a really neat illustration of how life changes and grows and evolves, you know, kind of happening right before our very eyes.
Big Bird, that's a new one. I love it. I love it. I love it. I'm going to go look that up when I sign off for the show, because I don't know anything about that new species of finch, non-finch. I'm going to check it out. Andrew Walsh, thank you so, so much for the gift of your time and your wisdom and your insight and your work for public health. Thanks for being with us today on The Thing with Feathers.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
The Thing with Feathers is produced by me, Courtney Ellis. Many thanks to Del Belcher for the music, to Todd Peterson for the name inspiration, and to Emily Dickinson for the beautiful poem and for being in the public domain. Until next time, my friends, keep looking up.
What does it go in your soul?
Yes, it does.